We're joined in this portion of our program on the WXRK Weekend Magazine. Welcome aboard. This is Bob Salter. We move into a discussion with Susan Gallimore on our program. Susan is joining with us to talk with us about a book that I have been reviewing in the past couple of weeks, actually, looking at the book Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror. The book is from Pluto Press, actually distributed by Palgrave Macmillan. It's nice to have you join us on our program, Susan.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
In your background, you are in this role as the founder of Mother Speak, and there's more information on that organization at motherspeak.org. You're the host for Raising Sand Radio, which is Raising Sand Radio, that's all this one word, .org, and you are a counselor on the GI Rights Hotline. And the other thing I'll mention, too, for the benefit of the people who are listening to our discussion today, we're going to talk a little bit about this and just a little bit about the fact that you are coming to New York City, actually, a little bit later this week. But
yeah, I'll be there on May 7th, Rutherford Place, the AFSC, American Friends Service Committee office.
In your words, your own words, why did you do this book?
Well, it started off because my son had joined the military. He was in college when he enlisted in 1999, and it was a real struggle to get him to change his mind, and I eventually thought, well, it's a volunteer military, he can get out if he doesn't like it. So I was not really understanding the concept of volunteer and the way it's used in this context, and when the war began in Afghanistan, he went off. He was deployed in 2003, supposedly for six months, and he ended up there for 9 months. He was extended 3 months, came back, and then was deployed 3 months later to Afghanistan. And at that point, I decided that it was enough and that I had to talk with my son about what happens to people in war. I had a pretty good sense, having grown up in a different culture, South Africa, and also being a voracious reader, I understood that war was not this heroic event where people came back better and wiser, but often came back quite traumatized, if not physically damaged. So off I went to tell my son when I actually met him in Iraq on the military base, I sat him down and I said, don't do anything in this country that you'll be ashamed of, because it will haunt you for the rest of your life. And that was what I needed to tell him. And we didn't really have a big discussion about it, but I felt like those words had come out and they were going to stay with him no matter what happened, and hopefully would pop up at a moment of real stress in combat, perhaps. And at the same time, I was talking with Iraqi mothers. I had been speaking with American military moms, having no idea of what a military family was, really, because there wasn't my background in this country. And so I started reaching out to military moms here and quickly realized that we didn't really understand what was going on in Iraq. So I made the journey part of a journey of understanding for myself, part of bringing back the stories from the Iraqi mothers, and then definitely focused on, if I could, talking with my son. And I was able to accomplish all of those three things. So, and then while I was there, I also realized that it was kind of a bigger story. This wasn't just about Afghanistan and Iraq. This was about foreign policy that the United States had that had effects that were happening in these countries. And when I say in these countries, I'm talking about Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, the occupied territories, Lebanon, Syria. Syria is really overcome with Iraqi refugees. And Afghanistan. And so I expanded the project and became determined to go to those countries and interview mothers there as I could, between, you know, job contracts and having to save money to do that and all of it. So that's how the book came about.
And in taking on this kind of a, I want to say the word challenge, but I'm going to use it as the term opportunity. Personally, for you, what sort of things were you going through, let's say, on an emotional basis as this actually lived out?
Well, many, many American military mothers that have been in this situation would be able to identify with what I was going through. Inability to concentrate, not being very fully functional at work. I work as a very highly responsible position as a project manager, not being able to function fully there, not getting enough sleep, waking up with nightmares, crying at inopportune moments, you know, just bursting out crying. Very stressful. After I got back from Iraq and my son was still in Iraq, it took me another 6 months before he came back. He came back in June, back to the United States, not back to my home. But and then I was able to pick up my head and realize that the whole winter had finished and spring was out and the flowers and trees had been in blossom for some time. So it's almost as if your whole world closes down when your child is in danger like that. And as I say, it's not specific to me. It's something that I've heard so many other mothers and parents talk about. It's a tremendously stressful.
Is that at all comforting to you as you're enduring that kind of stress to hear from others that they're going through this? Because my initial thought in hearing you say that is, okay, maybe you'd realize that at times, you know, the feeling might be almost like you're going crazy.
It is like you're going crazy, as a matter of fact. When I was in Israel and I was talking with an Israeli mother who had lost her daughter in a suicide bombing, and her two sons had subsequently become refusers. They refused to serve in the Israeli Defense Force anymore. She was very active. She's in a group called a Family Circle, and Palestinian and Israeli families work together. They've all been bereaved, and one way or another, one of their children or family members has been killed because of the conflict there. So they work together to try and bring about peace. And what she said was, here in Israel, the mothers are afraid to have their kids grow up to 18 because they know at that point that the kids are going to go into the military. And she said, so many mothers are on Prozac, and they talk to me about not being able to function properly. And my, Nurit is her name, Nurit said, my position is always, you shouldn't even consider Prozac because you're right. Your kids, you shouldn't be under this kind of stress. Your children should not be sent away to war in this way, and it's your right to refuse to send them. And I think that those were very powerful words for me because it's really affirmed a lot of what I had been feeling.
When you actually make that decision to go and visit your son in Iraq, what's the area like where you're going, and what's it like to physically even get into and get out of that area safely?
Yeah, well, we drove. I was with a women's delegation, and we drove from Amman to Baghdad in a three-car convoy, and it's highly recommended at that time that you drive in convoy. One vehicle is way too easy to pick off, and when I say pick off, there are highway robbers going up and down the highways looking for vulnerable vehicles and vulnerable people. So we were in a three-car convoy. We actually still, one of our vehicles was still hijacked, and money was stolen. No one was really badly hurt or anything, but money was stolen. And so it was dangerous, and this was in 2004, before the Abu Ghraib scandal broke. It was a few weeks before the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, and it was a couple of months before the first bombardment of Fallujah in April and May 2004. So there was a lot of violence going on, but nothing like the extreme violence uptick that we saw a little soon thereafter. But there were bombings, there were helicopters overhead all the time. There were, at one point I came out of an internet cafe where I'd been waiting for emails from my son and walked into a cordon-off street, and I was admonished by the U.S. troops there to get back to my hotel as soon as possible. So there was a lot going on. And the area that my son was in is was known as the Sunni Triangle, and was about 40 miles north of Baghdad in a town near Balad. And what I did was I hired a driver, and the first driver that I'd had would have been perfect candidate because he had actually been AWOL, absent without leave, as a colonel in Saddam Hussein's military during the Iran-Iraq war. He decided that war was nothing that he wanted to have anything to do with, and he managed to stay unencumbered by the security apparatus for 20 years. So I felt very safe with him, but at the last moment he changed his mind, and I ended up driving with a very young fellow, 23 years old, who was actually Shia, going into a Sunni area. All of this I only found out on the way up. And we got to the base, and I had already informed the public affairs officer that I was coming, gave her an approximate time, an exact date, And I came to the base, and of course I was dressed with a hijab, a head covering, because that's appropriate to the culture there, the rural culture particularly. And the troops didn't recognize me at first and were very threatening toward me. But when I took off my hijab and really flashed my American passport, the whole tenor of their negativity changed, and they became very excited to see me. What are you doing here? Why are you here? I wish my mom would come and visit me, that sort of thing. So it was, you know, it was, I would say, one of the best things that I've done as a mother was to visit my kid, because I not only did I get to say that statement, which I thought would be helpful to him, but it also helped me understand where he was and the condition that he was living under and the condition of the other troops and the general culture of Iraq. So, yeah, it was a good thing to have done, even though it may seem to an outsider to be a little extreme.
Did you, at times, and especially during this whole situation, think about the potential danger that you faced?
Well, you know, Bob, what I did was, when I was thinking about it, now, clearly my thinking wasn't as logical as it would have been had I been under normal circumstances. There was a lot of stress. But when I was thinking about going, I realized that if I decided to go, I had to go with a full my full energy, and I couldn't be second-guessing myself all the time. So I tried to put aside, you know, take into account the danger that was there, and then put it aside, because I felt I'd be much less effective in finding my kid and in talking to Iraqis if I was carrying around a burden of fear for my own safety. So I put that aside, and I went there with what I felt was a reasonably full awareness, as much as you can, you know, understand about a war zone, to go there and to accomplish what I was hoping to accomplish, and do it in a way that really kept my integrity intact. You know, tell the Iraqi people, my son is a soldier in this country. He's here now. He's active. He's in Balad. He's on a base. And I want to hear your story about what's happening in your country. And it was so humbling to have these people be so generous. They were really interested in knowing, why are you mothers? Why are you American mothers sending your children here? What do you hope to accomplish by this? And yes, I want to share my story with you. And they were so generous in sharing what was going on with them. So I really felt as though, you know, that the putting aside the danger, and again, there was a, in fact, when we were leaving, over one of the bridges, it was a very foggy day. There was a military convoy, United States military convoy, coming down on the traffic into Baghdad. We were leaving from Baghdad. There was an explosion in that convoy, and I thought it was a hubcap. I really don't know what it was, because later I thought, well, maybe it's not a hubcap, because they don't have hubcaps in Humvees, do they? It rolled across the freeway, and right in front of us, the driver saw it, and I felt the percussion, because I was looking out the curtain. You have curtains in your cars there. I was looking through the curtain, because I thought my kid might be in that convoy. And so that's how I left Baghdad, an explosion, high-speed chase out of the city, and not knowing if my kid was in that convoy or not. It was really traumatizing to leave that way. So, again, but it was the sense of, okay, I'm here, let's be here fully, and let's not second guess, and let's do what we came to do.
Susan, I want to hear what the people that you interviewed, that you spoke with, said about the ousting of Saddam Hussein. But for the benefit of people who've just joined us in our discussion, let me mention the fact that we're talking with Susan Gallimore on our program. She's talking with us about the new book, Long Time Passing, published by Pluto Press, distributed by Palgrave Macmillan. Longtime Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror. Susan has joined us by phone on our program. There is a companion website to the book at Mothers Speak About War and Terror. That's all as one word, .org. And Susan is sharing with us in our discussion. We'll also get into, in just a minute or two, talking about the fact that you are visiting the city this week.
Yeah. So your question was, can you repeat it? Sorry about that.
This idea of the ousting of Saddam Hussein.
Okay.
There was a picture painted for people in this country, many people, that the citizens of Iraq were, in most cases, jubilant at the ousting of Saddam Hussein. Was that really the case with the people that you spoke with?
Well, it was mixed. You know, there were some people that were still jubilant about it. I actually was in that square, the Firdaus Square, where the statue had been pulled down, and we saw the footage of all of those Iraqis. It looked like multitudes of Iraqis. In fact, it's a very small, it's not even a square, it's actually a traffic circle. And I mentioned a few moments ago that there had been a cordon off of a street. It was actually there, an IED had been set in that square. So it was a very, it had a lot of recent history. But there was a lot of miscommunication by the media about what had happened there. And some Iraqis were still kind of jubilant that Iraq, that Saddam was no longer in. On the other hand, I talked with an Iraqi psychologist, Dr. Ali, who said, you know, what we need to understand is that Saddam, for whatever he was, he was seen as the figurehead of this country by young children. Now, Dr. Ali was a psychologist, as I say, but his focus was post-traumatic stress disorder in young children. And he said, suddenly what they see is this hero, this man that's portrayed as a hero. You see his face here and there and everywhere, and they see this man toppled. You know, he was still missing at that point. He was undercover. So he'd run off and hidden from this invading force. And then they see these invading, this invading force come in, and at the time, the 82nd Airborne was very active in the area that I was in, and they were becoming very well known for brutal tactics. They would come into houses in the middle of the night, pull Iraqis out of their houses in their pajamas or in their nightclothes, and this is a tremendous shame for Muslim culture to be out in public in this way. And the men of the family would be forced to the ground, and the soldiers would have a boot on their head. Now, the structure of the culture there is that the older members of the family are already honored, and to see the male members, the elderly male members of the family on the ground like that is very traumatizing for kids. So these are all images that the children were seeing, and from that point of view, very, very distressing. And I think that Dr. Ali was right. We're not really thinking about the effects of war that aren't even combat, just the day-to-day drumming into children that their whole world has changed. The next thing you see is television images of troops of children like them begging in the street. So there's a lot to war that we're not really taking fully into account.
And when you spoke with Iraqi women for the book, what did they say about their lives under Saddam Hussein's regime versus their lives now?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting because there's a perception that Saddam was not pro-female. In fact, he made it a point to elevate women into very responsible positions. Now, this has partly come about because so many men had been killed off in the Iran-Iraq War, as we know. So there's a dearth of adult males there, and that continues to be the case. So the women had been elevated into very good positions. They were getting very good educations. Most of the time, in fact, the education is free there. If you have the ability, you're given an education. And it's very possible to go as far as a PhD there, a female or male. And so the perception that women there are all repressed and have to wear the hijab is just inaccurate. While we were there, we participated in a demonstration that the Iraqi women had organized with banners, and the slogans were things like, we demand full rights for Iraqi women after this occupation. So the tendency was to realize that things were going to be changing for the worst for women, and to try and get out there and raise their voices to remain in the position that they had become accustomed to under Saddam. And of course, we've seen the exact opposite of that happen now.
Now, we've alluded a couple of times to the fact that you're coming to New York City this week. Would you tell us about the event?
Yes, it's my pleasure. It is at American Friends Service Committee, which is 12 Rutherford Place in New York. What I'm doing in each of these events is inviting the people that are affected by war to join us, And in New York, we have a tremendously impressive lineup. We have an MC who is Jeremy Scahill, as we know, Jeremy Scahill of the Blackwater Research. We also have Dr. Donnie George, who is the former director of the Iraq Museum. He's going to be speaking there. He's going to be speaking as a representative of a group called SAFE, Save Antiquities for Everyone. He'll be, of course, talking about the looting of the museum. We'll have Elik Elhanan. I alluded to his mother earlier, Nurit, whose child was killed in a suicide bombing. Elik is is her son. He's an IDF refuser. He'll be speaking. We also have Ihab al-Kutub, who is an Iraqi former translator for the American military. He'll be speaking about what it's like to have a foot in both cultures, American culture as a translator and Iraqi culture as, quote-unquote, almost a traitor to some minds in Iraq. And we also have a couple of military moms. Rita Doherty's son was a lieutenant. He was very badly injured in a striker attack. A bomb exploded under his striker, and he almost lost his foot and has other injuries up and down one side of his body. And then a mother from the 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, Alyssa, will be with us also. So a very impressive lineup, and I'm really, really looking forward to it because each of these people will be speaking from their perspective about how the war has affected the people and the communities that they represent. And again, that's American Friends Service Committee, 12 Rutherford Place in New York, and it's May 7th at 7 o'clock.
Is there a website at all?
Yes, if people go to www.motherspeakaboutwarandterror.org, motherspeakaboutwarandterror.org, they'll see the tour page. They can go to click on the tour page, and all of that information will come up, as well as other events. So it would be great to have people show up. I think it's going to be a really lively and interesting and exciting evening because trying to bring together communities to reach across to one another and realize our commonalities and begin to raise our voices from those commonalities.
When you interviewed people for the book, in some cases they wanted you to send messages back to people in this country mm-hmm. and to the government of this country. What is it they wanted to say?
One of the mothers who had lost three children and a husband in a quote-unquote random shooting incident in Baghdad. Her family was basically shot to death in the street by our young troops in two Humvees. She said to me, tell Americans there is tragedy in Iraq. And so that really became my rallying cry. She was the first person I met in Baghdad the first day I was there, and it really shocked me to the bone because these children, these young people on this Humvee that shot her family to death are the children of somebody in this country. And those young people, rather, are going to be remembering that incident. So tell Americans there is tragedy in Iraq is one of the messages. Another message from a woman in Lebanon, a very small village in Lebanon, said, what is democracy? Is democracy something that is grown from inside, or is it something that's imposed from outside? If it's imposed from outside, isn't that occupation? And I think this is an excellent question, because here in the United States, our democracy, I believe, is really under fire. I think we've seen 8 years of a total diminishing of our citizens' power. And it's been a slow process over a couple of decades. But I think we really need to stop and look at what democracy means. It's not something that's imposed on a people. It's something that grows out of the energy and the desires for a political direction of the people. So those are the kinds of messages I heard. The other ones were, we don't hate Americans. We're not sure where this is coming from. This business of we hate you for your freedoms. She said that's not true at all. These mothers, and it wasn't just one of them, they would say, it's not true at all. We look up to and respect Americans. We love the idea of what America stands for. We don't understand why you have these sorts of policies towards us, though. We love the people. We distinguish the people from the government, and we do not understand or really like the direction of the government, the American government. And I think it's really key to understand that there is that ability to distinguish between the people and the governments. And I think it would be really wonderful if Americans could begin to have that same sort of sophistication around what democracy is and what our freedom, what our foreign policies do, and what really the nature of freedom is. I think it's a discussion that we're yearning to have in this country.
What is the feedback been generally that you have gotten for the book?
Well, it's been generally positive. Even the military families who initially feel as though I'm betraying the military by talking about this, when I say to them, you know, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a military. I think that is totally naive in a world that we live in today. What I am saying is, let's understand what our leadership, our military leadership, is doing to our young people. There are a lot of young people in the military who have been recruited in with ways and means that they feel are fraudulent. Let's understand what that means. Let's understand that if people are going into the military that don't want to be there, we're endangering the people that do want to be there. We're not being fully respectful of the people that don't want to and the people that do want to be there. Let's look at what our training does to people in the military. Let's look at what happens to our people when they come back from combat. Why are we having such a tremendously high suicide rate, including among recruiters? Let's not demonize any of these soldiers, and including the recruiters. Let's find a way to examine, as a country and as a citizenship, as citizens, to examine what the military stands for. And I'm a mother who's taken some steps to do that, but I also urge people to read widely. Read people like Dr. Basevich. He's a regular mainstream professor. He was in the military in Vietnam. He was an officer. His son was killed in Iraq. This man has studied foreign policy and history throughout his career, and he is asking some very deep questions about what the military does. Read Dr. Basevich. Read people like Colonel Grossman. He wrote an excellent book called On Killing. He talks about the training. He talks about the effects of that training, and he talks about the effects of war. And his question is, what are we doing to our troops, and why do we not support them when they come back? So those kinds of things, I'm suggesting there's information out there, and the citizenry, an active citizenry in a democracy, must ask these questions, and they must come up with answers that we can debate with amongst ourselves. We need to be able to talk to one another. We need to be able to listen to one another, and this demonizing of the left or the right or the peaceniks or the warmongers, all of that we have to try and find a way to stop doing and find new ways to reach out to one another.
Some people say that the downturn in the economy has been an uptick for the military, especially when it comes to recruitment. What's the reality of that?
I believe that's true. There's always been what we call a poverty draft. When I was a counselor on the GI Rights Hotline, I got a lot of calls from people who had discovered that the military wasn't what they thought, but they had to join because it was one of the only options in their little town. We call that the poverty draft, and we're seeing that now more and more young people are not getting the opportunities that a great and rich country like ours ought to be offering. We ought to have other ways of educating our children besides making them troops. So let's, you know, talk about what that means, and let's really examine how we go about getting people in there, and let's examine whether a country like ours, the richest country on the face of the earth ever, needs to be putting itself in the position of having this thing called a poverty draft. Let's find other ways to make our young, creative people viable citizens of the nation.
There is something very important in your work, I think, that I want to mention before we close in our discussion. You're very kind with your time. This concept of No Child Left Behind was introduced a number of years back and has been a hotly debated issue in this country.
Yeah.
What is it that you say all parents of teenage boys in this country should know?
Well, teenage boys and girls. The No Child Left Behind Act has actually been tightened up in the last year or so. What it does is it allows military recruiters to go onto high school campuses, even grade school campuses they're going onto, or middle school campuses, rather. It allows them full access to our kids, And in order to opt, you have to opt out of that. And even then, the recruiters themselves say, sure, you can opt out, but the only way we're not going to talk to your kid about joining the military is if your kid is dead. And I think that's really hard-nosed. Parents need to understand, and this is something that I did not understand, is that there's a tremendous coercion going on to get our kids into the military. There's a tremendous marketing effort. We see television ads all the time now about what a great and wonderful career opportunity this is. That's not accurate. The career opportunity usually ends up being promises of being a helicopter pilot or a doctor or a physician's assistant, a medic, or so on. And the reality is when the kids get there, they're coerced into signing up in the infantry. The recruiters are under no obligation to follow through on any of the promises they told your kids. So even if you would feel proud to have your kids serve in the military, and I'm not saying you should not, I'm saying find out what that means and do it before it's too late. Get your kids to talk to some of the other troops that are coming back, Iraq Veterans Against the War, Veterans for Peace. There's lots of groups out there. Get your kids to talk to them. Now, it's possible that your kid will still want to sign up, but you need to do everything as a parent to understand what your kid is getting into. Otherwise, you're betraying your job as a parent, is what I believe. You're betraying your job as a parent by not being informed. So it's your job to understand what No Child Left Behind is really about, and it's your job to opt out if that's what you want. The other thing is, if you're under any apprehensions about what the No Child Left Behind is, please get hold of groups like the GI Rights Hotline, because we can help you sort through it. We don't give you advice. We don't tell you what to do. We tell you what is happening in the military at that time, what's happening on different bases, because every base is a little different, in fact. And we tell you what happens when the military recruiters harass you. They're not allowed to do that. There is there's information that prevents them from doing that. And you need to know that information. You need to understand if your troop has gone AWOL. You need to understand what the process is. It's different for the Army. It's different for the Marines. It's different for the Air Force. You need to understand specifically what is applicable to your AWOL or conscientious objector troop. And we can give you that information on the GI Rights Hotline. So do not hesitate. Call. We have nothing to do with the military. We have nothing to do with the government. It's privately sponsored, and you don't pay for the call. It's free. So find out before rather than after your kid signs up.
What is the number?
Oh, that's a good question. We've actually, if you look it up, GIRightsHotline.org, you'll find there are different numbers according to what part of the country you're in. There's also numbers for people calling from Japan, from Germany, from Italy. There are different numbers. So GI Rights Hotline, do a search, and you'll get all of the information that you need.
Susan Gallimore, our guest in this portion of our program on the WXRK Weekend Magazine, longtime passing mothers speak about war and terror. The book, published by Pluto Press, distributed by Palgrave Macmillan. Susan, you're very kind with your time and joining us. You're the founder of Mother Speak, MothersSpeak, that's all as one word, .org on the web. Host of Raising Sand Radio, Raising Sand Radio, all as one word, .org, and a counselor on the GI Rights Hotline, the companion website for the book Mothers Speak About War and Terror. Again, all is one word, .org.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.